Hello everyone, welcome back to another Bite Mark special episode, and joining us is our very special guest, Kit Bosch. Say hello, Kit Bosch.
It's nice to be back on.
So, for those of you who are just joining us, Kit Bosch, why don't you introduce yourself and tell us about what it is that you do?
So what I do, or what I'm known for on YouTube anyway, is I kit bash different tabletop miniatures into... I customize them into a form that I like more. So a simple version of kit bashing would be switching over a model's helmet or a gun or something like that. But I tend to do things that are a little bit more ambitious.
You basically make, I would argue, you basically make new models by cannibalizing old ones.
A lot of people have said I should just sculpt them at this point, and I don't think they understand how difficult that is. So, you know, I wouldn't go quite that far, but I do try to do things that are a little bit outside the norm and more ambitious.
Yeah, you know, it would be like telling someone who makes model trains, why don't you just go and make your own train, dude?
It's a little bit more complicated than that.
Plus, you know, I've always said this. I will defend this maybe with my dying breath. But I really like the models that you make. I like the fact that they are taken. They have a feel that they are actually kit bashed. That you took kits. That you recombined the best elements. Sure, you use some green stuff here and there, but I think really for the most part, most of your models give a really handmade appearance to them, and I think that's why I like them so much. And, you know, of course, I like the fact that they're not painted. I think that just gives them extra character.
Like I said last time, you're the only one, so we'll see. I've started priming them, but, you know, that's as far as I'll go, probably.
Yeah, you know, I think it's important for you to differentiate yourself as a channel, because there are guys, Pete the Wargamer is a good example. He's a fairly, I would argue, restrained kit basher in terms of his ideas. You know, he will mostly use parts that are readily available. He'll do mostly, you know, he does great stuff. Don't get me wrong, he does amazing stuff, but he really focuses on delivering a finished painted miniature. What I want to see when I watch your channel is I want to see you go wild. I want to see you go crazy with stuff.
You know, it's interesting. I was thinking about that the other day, in that, you know, me and him have a very similar on the surface channel, but it's actually very different in that our objectives are different. Yeah. He's very much doing tutorials.
Yeah.
So that's why his videos tend to be 10 minutes long. They tend to be somewhat restrained, and they're like, this is how you customize this Space Marine step by step. Where mine are very, I'm trying to create something and come along with the journey. So yeah, that's why a lot of times I double back, and I'll show that I double back and try something and it doesn't work. So I'll try something else.
Yeah, you see, that's the charm, I think, of that kind of content, because it makes the audience feel as if they're involved in the creative process. Whereas Pete will, and you know, who knows, maybe we can have him on and the two of you can have a conversation. That would be interesting. But
definitely.
You involve us in the conversation, and we can see, oh, you made this part, but it didn't work out. You tried this thing, you didn't. And then you get to feel at the end that the model is really something custom. And one day, eventually, we will get big enough orc heads.
Yeah, I'm working on that. I won't say what I'm doing, but I'm working on it.
Okay, so the topic for today is one that I think I've had in the back of my mind for quite a while. And it's something that, you know, we kind of touched on a little bit in the last episode that we were talking about. But basically, what is your experience with the gene stealer cults?
You know, I haven't kitbashed any of their models yet, but I am familiar with them in terms of the lore.
So let me just, I have to say this because a fan was asking, actually a couple of fans. Are you going to kitbash a giant gene stealer mutant creature at some point in the future?
You know, it's interesting. The gene stealers are one of those factions that's actually very easy to convert for.
Hmm.
Kind of like the orcs and chaos, in that you can take a standard imperial model and put... You can take a standard imperial model and... add gene stealer bits, and it looks really cool. Same way you can take, you know, a normal lemon rust tank, and if you add orky bits to it, it looks orky.
Yeah.
But one thing I found with kit bashing is that you need to have a range of bits before you can really effectively come up with an idea. So for every helmet I use, I have to have five that I look at and go, okay, this doesn't work and this doesn't work. And this one works. And right now, I'm not really willing to invest the money to get a wide range of Tyranid and Genestealer bits to do that. But I actually think that would be a really cool idea to do like some massive
Yeah,
pooler.
I for me personally, and you know, I think the best way to do a little bit of the intro is to just talk about the models because I think they are really, really good models. If you are a person who's looking to do like any kind of post-apocalyptic, any kind of like Mad Max, even any kind of like almost sci-fi kind of war game, then a lot of the Genestealer cults minis will be ideal. Like for example, the hybrid, I think they're called Acolytes, or some of the leaders like the Clavis or you know the Magnus, they look really, really cool. And one of the interesting things about the Genestealers is you have basically two different design aesthetics. You've got Imperial design aesthetics and you've got you know Tyranid design aesthetics. And in some units, like I think they're called the hybrid metamorphs, the clash is like it's striking. You've got a guy who looks like a hunched over industrial worker carrying a power saw, but he's got four hands and he's got a weird bulbous Tyranid head. And then in the other guy, you might see, oh, well, it's just a guardsman. But then you look closely, you see, oh, wait, maybe he's got a third eye. Oh, why is he covering his neck? Why is he wearing a bandana? You know? And that's because he's a mutant. And,
Yeah, I really love their design language for a couple of reasons. On the so for one thing, they're a newer model, so they tend to look
Oh,
quite
yeah.
good, and they're not as static. But I love that they're very sort of the early rogue trader
Yeah.
weird sci-fi look, especially their kind of black ribbed armor. It's very like it's very organic and also weird looking while also kind of making sense. And then the other thing I like about them, which will tie in a little bit more to what we're talking later about in terms of their lore, is that they look very lower class in terms of like you immediately get the just looking at them, you're like, oh, okay, this is a lower class insurrection kind of boiling in the undercity of or the under,
Yeah, in
you
the
know,
hive,
hive of these cities. And then they're coming out. And that's a really cool look into just imperial culture in general.
And of
And
course,
like that's cool for conversions as
and of
well.
course, it really plays into you know mechanically because the Genestealer cults have that ambush rule, which means that they can start quite a number of their models off the table at the beginning of the game, and ambush you. Represent you know they're coming from the sewers. They're coming from every nook and crevice. They are, you know, going to overwhelm you. That's one of the nice things about the army, just from a mechanical perspective, is they really have a very strong connection between how they're meant to be represented in lore and how you can actually play them in the game. And so,
Interesting. I don't play, so I've never like done that, but I do.
I've played maybe two games against a Genestealer cult army, and both times, I was. I one time I was playing as Imperial Guard, and the other time I was playing as Space Marines. And both times I had my army, I had deployed everything, and then I looked at the opponent and was like, I'm not really going to deploy a lot of stuff. And then I saw him put down a bunch of tokens on the map, and I thought, uh-oh, that's bad. And then, you know, as the game went on, he would ambush, you know, a unit from this piece of terrain or that piece of terrain. Maybe a bunch of units would emerge, and then my units were out of position. Sometimes it would be easy to smash them, sometimes not. They have one particular unit called a Aberrant. That thing hits like a truck. That thing hits harder than a Space Marine in Terminator armor with a Thunder Hammer. It does more damage. It's
No, it's
insane.
interesting. You're this is maybe a little bit of insight into how I get ideas to Kitbash, but you're really the way you're describing it is making me really want to try to convert one, or convert a couple that kind of play more into that ambush scenario. So like maybe some coming like scrabbling out of the water or something like that, or scrabbling or kind of ones that because the models are really cool, but they don't look like they're ambushing somebody, and that might be cool to put into the model.
I remember seeing in a very old White Dwarf a really cool Tyranid model for a lictor, but the majority of the model was actually ruined building, and in the middle using sort of paint using paint effects. Basically, they had created a light source of a wounded Imperial guardsman holding a torch, looking up, and in front of him, mostly shrouded by, you know, darkness, the way that it was painted, was a lictor, and that was the lictor model. I thought, oh my goodness, that's amazing. That's a really cool idea. That really represents, oh, the lictor is a stealth assassin. But let's talk a little bit about the lore, because one more thing. One of the Gene Stealer cult's model, I think it's the Clavis. I can't exactly be sure, but it's the one that is the cult's communication specialist. He has a table. This is a bit of trivia, but the table that he's planning his cult operations on, if you look at it from the top, it looks like the top view of Warhammer World.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, the Games Workshop HQ, which is really funny, I think. But anyway, so who are these Gene Stealer cults? Well, Warhammer is a very diverse game in terms of having many different kinds of aliens. Broadly speaking, there are three groups of units or factions in the game. The first are Imperium, you know, obviously, Sisters of Battle, Space Marines, Imperial Guard, etc. Then you've got Chaos, which are everything that the Imperials are, but spikier and with more flesh. And then you have Xenos. Now, the Xenos factions are not really united. They are very different factions that all group together into an umbrella. And they run a gamut from things like orcs, which are, you know, very aggressive, very Mad Max kind of post-apocalyptic sometimes, you know, setting. And then they have things like Necrons, which look like robots, but, you know, very space Egyptian. Tyranids, I think, are one of maybe perhaps the most expected or stereotypical sci-fi race, because they are the bugs in space. They are like the bugs from Starship Troopers, who serve at the behest of a infinitesimally massive hive mind intelligence that just wants to eat everything, right? The Tyranid MO is to show up to a planet, overwhelm the defenders, eat everyone, and then move on to the next planet.
Yeah, one of the things that's actually not quite related, but one of the things that's kind of interesting about them is that they're very insectile now. Some of the earlier ones were a little bit more dinosaurish, almost. You can see that in the names with like Carnifex. But that's just kind of an aspect of them that got reduced as they became more of a chittering horde that consumes biomass.
Yeah, I totally would agree. There's a Tyranid model called a Haradan, which is used for Apocalypse. It's like a flying dragon. It's actually really cool. It's a flying Tyranid creature that can't land. So it's like an aircraft carrier, but for gargoyles, I think it is. And yeah, you know, the Tyranids didn't always use... A lot of the space models, if you play Battlefleet Gothic, are very, like, squiddy. They're very, like, aquatic in nature. You've got, like, narwhals, these nautilus-looking creatures. Very different to most of the rank and file, I would say. But yeah, so Tyranids don't really... Okay, so one of the problems with the Tyranids, I think, is that the way that they are designed, the faction has very little personality. It's very hard to relate to a bug creature, right? That has no personality, doesn't really have its own desires and opinions. And it's very difficult for them to build character, I would say. You know, not like, oh, you know, this is a Space Marine captain and he did all of these different things, or, you know, here's an orc warlord that is really cool and he's got a bike. The Tyranids, for me, are really not so much an individualistic group. They are more, as they are, you know, designed to be sort of this collective. Your entire army has a character, not so much, you know, every individual unit. I'm not sure if you...
I think they also have the problem... Well, it's both... What you're saying, I think, is both a strength and a weakness in that they have that kind of Lovecraftian elemental strangeness. But the problem with that is that the more you explore that, the less powerful that idea gets. And so, yeah, for the Tyranids, they're one monohive.
Yeah.
But if you explore them more than that, then they become less cool. But at the same time, they're sort of boring.
They do.
So it's a problem.
They do have
one
some.
Thing I will.
Sorry.
One thing I did find really interesting is this is back when I first started Warhammer. Back when I was like 13, there is an anthology, and one of the books, one of the short stories, One of the stories that I ran into in an anthology series I started reading when I was like 13, before I even really knew what the Tyranids were, but I was reading Warhammer, was from the perspective of a gene stealer cult. And it was really fascinating. I tried to find it so I could reread it for this podcast, but I couldn't find it in time. But they referred to the incoming hive as like the mother, and you got a lot of the religiosity that the gene stealers have for the incoming cult. And it was really fascinating and really cool, and I always kind of missed that flavor in the actual Tyranids, which are very just
Yeah,
bug-like
bland.
and
You
scientific.
can't really get a perspective from a Tyranid character because they only have one objective: kill everything and eat it. But that is a good segue.
I think that actually also kind of taints the gene stealers a little bit, because they're only, if they win, they get consumed and become
No
personalityless.
spoiler
And
alert.
so like
We'll get to that.
okay, go ahead.
So if the Tyranids are this weird, insectoid hive species, then what are exactly gene stealer cults? Well, the gene stealer itself is one of the most iconic units of the Tyranid. They are basically lightning with teeth. If you think about some of the, in fact, the gene stealers were originally part of Rogue Trader. That's how old they are. They are ancient in terms of being part of, Warhammer lore. Gene stealers are infiltrators of the hive species. What they do is they go ahead of the hive fleets and they land on planets, or they're in derelict spaceships. They can su survive hibernating for a very long time. And then basically they're kind of like xenomorphs. So when someone comes up to, they get, oh, they stumble upon the derelict ship, or one of the gene stealers lands on a planet, then the gene stealers will seek out hosts, infect them, by quote unquote corrupting their DNA, and then that host that is infected will then produce infected offspring that are all psychically connected to the first gene stealer of the brood, who becomes like the primarch of a cult that forms. So what happens is, why gene stealer cults are
I
so
think it's called a patriarch, just
yeah so, sorry
before people complain in the comments that we don't know what we're talking about. I think it,
Oh right,
you know.
yeah, no. The Broodlord is just the Tyranid specific version of the Gene Stealer. The Patriarch is the the Patriarch. So the Patriarch essentially will form a nascent cult, and this is why Gene Stealers are so dangerous. Because if Gene Stealers get into your society, they will infect people. Those people will produce infected offspring, and then they will all congregate together into a cult dedicated to undermining, whatever society that you're in. For various reasons, mostly biological, humans are kind of the ideal species for gene stealer cult infestation. The Eldari, they have psychic detection and stuff like that. The orcs, their society is way too violent to really brook a gene stealer cult, and various other reasons. But once the cult develops, what will happen is the Patriarch will try to grow the numbers of the cult, infiltrate members of, society, and then take over the society and wait for the Tyranids to come and devour the planet, like you said. One of the things that's interesting is kind of the cycle that this goes through. So if you imagine you've got a gene stealer that infects someone, the first generation of people that are born will be kind of very hideously mutated. They will be very obviously alien, in nature, some hybrid of Tyranid and, human in this case.
And to be clear, hideous is maybe a strong word. We don't want to, we don't want to shame anyone for their body. We want to be body positive here. So just.
A fun fact: the original patriarch, I keep calling him Primarch, the original patriarch model was a fat, like, dude on a throne, a fat gene stealer on a throne. And then in the new one, they've trimmed him up and they've made him like buff. So I think Games Workshop have some explaining to do in terms of their model choices. But it's interesting. Like every generation from the initial infection becomes more and more like the host species, but then the fifth generation is a pure strain gene stealer, and the cycle continues. So it's like you said. The Gene Steeler cult, and they really are a cult. They have a religious veneration of the Tyranids, right? Something that is often joked about in you know the Gene Steeler cult circles is the Gene Stealers aren't heretical. They worship the four-armed emperor, right? And a lot of the times, if you think about like a lot of the art or depictions, they have a version of the emperor, but he's got four arms, right? And that is because they are hijacking, in a way, the imperial cult and turning it into a vehicle to spread their gospel. Another one is the Star Saviors. So, you know, you were talking about it, but I think it's very important to mention here. The Gene Stealer cults are not... They form on imperial planets for one very specific, and I mentioned that humans are ideal for it. Well, the reason is because it's not imperial society is not very good. It's not very nice to live in, you know, for the majority of people. If you're a person who lives in a hive city, you have to work long hours, extremely long hours, for very little pay, if you get paid at all. Sometimes you just get food and really just recycled paste at that. The conditions are oppressive and terrible. And then, hang on, here's someone with a powerfully hypnotic voice. They're telling you, hang on, we don't have to live like this. We can do better for ourselves. You know, we can live in the clean air. We can have abundant food. We just have to deal with these people, these parasites at the top of our society who are leeching from us, who are taking us from the true path. You know, will you join us, brother or sister? And that's kind of basically the MO of the Gene Stealer cults. They land on planets, they build up these massive cults, and then if the Gene Stealers sense the Hive Fleet is approaching, they rise up, and as you mentioned, unfortunately, if the Tyranids happen to win, they are usually the first people thrown into the digestion pool.
Yeah, so I think what's interesting is that there is an interesting kind of perspective to have. Games Workshop could emphasize more that the Gene Stealers are only really able to gain a foothold and be so effective in Imperium specifically because the Imperium has these blind spots and vulnerabilities in terms of its fascist hierarchy. So there are these inequalities and there is this mindless devotion to the Emperor that can be hijacked.
Yeah.
And so in another society that's more democratic, they wouldn't be able to gain as much of a foothold, but that goes against the whole Imperium creed.
Yeah, you know, it's telling. There are a variety of, you know, I haven't really seen much to indicate that Tyranids typically, Gene Stealer cults can typically foster themselves in, for example, say, Tau societies, which are, you know, not perfect by any means. They are definitely, you know, with problems, but they are more egalitarian. I think the average living standard of the average Tau person is a lot better than the average Imperial citizen. So, you know, the idea of a Gene Stealer cult landing on a Tau planet has to do a lot of work to actually undermine the Tau system, because for the most part, the people of the Tau Empire are better taken care of. And so, you know, no, they're not going to be as swayed by this argument that, hey, you know, you don't have enough to eat, but that guy up in the spire, he's probably eating like 30 times what you are. And it is really a problem with Imperial society because, again, you know, they have, okay, it's a fascistic, but it's also a feudal order, right? I think one of the interesting things, maybe not interesting, but one of the things that differentiates the kind of fascism that you see in Warhammer 40K from, you know, a lot of the fascism that we see in real life is it is, by kind of definition, very feudal in nature. It's almost like this, the natural order of feudalism is taken to its most logical extreme, where the people who rule are kind of destined to rule, you know, by birthright. The people at the top of the imperial system are kind of, for the most part, there are some exceptions, but for the most part, they are an entrenched kind of system that maintain their power through force. You know, it's often noted in the lore that imperial hive cities, most imperial planets really are not nice places to live. There are a handful of places in the Imperium, pleasure worlds, you know, resort planets, that kind of stuff, where actually if you are a person on that planet, it's actually a pretty good deal. But most of the Imperium, you know, 99.9%, they'll never get to see that. And, you know, that's how the Gene Stealer cults survive, because there's discontent. They can use that discontent to build a inroads into the communities, and they can use that to kind of resist. Have you heard about the Kellermorph model?
No.
All right, so the Kellermorph is my favorite model in the Gene Stealer's Cult, and I honestly wish I could just buy one of those individually for myself. So get this. The Kellermorph is a gunslinger. The Kellermorph is a three-armed gunslinger. He's got three pistols. He's got three revolvers. And he wears a, you know...
See him. Yeah, he's a really cool one.
Yeah, he's got a poncho. He's got, like, a cowboy look. And it's just so real. It's such a cool model because, you know, it's got a lot of personality. And what is the lore for the Kellermorph? Well, he's a figure of resistance to the Imperium, you know, a folk hero, a bandit who lives outside of Imperial society, you know, that gets used by the cult to do targeted assassinations, etc., etc. And lots of people in the cult, you know, die literally to give the Kellermorph its special ammunition that can, you know, shoot through power armor. And, you know, the Kellermorph is a great example, not only of, you know, a lot of this design stuff that we're talking about. It really is a really good model. But it also is a, you know, a symbol of, yeah, Imperial society produces these villains. It produces its own sort of conditions that necessitate, or rather, not necessitate, but allow the fostering of these cults. And as you mentioned, Imperial society can't really change, right? You can't really make the entirety of the Imperium, you know, better without changing what is fundamentally the Imperium. And so, you know, this problem with the Gene Stealer cults will persist and in some cases, you know, get worse because right now the Imperium is kind of hard-pressed to deal with all of its problems. It's kind of in the collapse phase of the collapse that it's currently in. So, you know, the real issue is, okay, so you're probably listening to us and going, okay, well, you know, the Imperium is bad, sure. The Gene Stealer cults, they are a representation of, you know, the enemy. I think it's the enemy without, you know, the Xenos threat. And, you know, why is that really important? Well, here's the thing. And you can agree with this or disagree with this, Kitbosh. From my perspective, there are no alternatives to Imperial society. And Imperial society, because it's a fascist system, because it's a terrible system, the fact that we have no good alternatives, not even a single real alternative to the Imperium that is not chaos, we're going to eat your soul, or, you know, Gene Stealers, we're actually, you know, we're trying to quote-unquote fight for you, but then the minute we win, you're going to be thrown into a pit and digested, you know, that's a problem, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, it's what happens is that because the Imperium is the hero race, everyone it's kind of a classic anti-hero problem that people have in television and movies, which is if you have an anti-hero, you need to have even worse villains. And so that flattens almost all of the resistance or forces against the Imperium. So the Gene Stealers can't have a point because, or they can't have a legitimate criticism of the Imperium because they have to be worse. And in the end, the Imperium always has to be the best choice among a lot of flawed choices. And that kind of just flattens them, I think.
Yeah, it's a really good use of phraseology there because, you know, we've often complained, I often complain, that one of the big problems with the 40K setting, why I think it has such a reactionary appeal, is because the faction that people are most going to empathize with, most going to relate with, and most going to engage with is not a good faction, right? And maybe in the early days of Rogue Trader, you could very clearly see that the satire about how bad the Imperium was a lot more present. But over time, over accretion, you know, over executive decisions to sell more models, we've seen this crystallization of this idea that, yeah, you know, everything is bad in the Imperium. They are fascist, at least, you know, they're supposed to be. But everyone else is much worse. And, you know, that is totally correct. Because the Gene Stealers are correct, right? The cults are correct. The Imperial Society is rotten to its core. The majority of people are oppressed, exploited, beaten down, abused, etc. And the Imperium has no desire to change this order, provided it can keep on chugging. However, the fact that the Gene Stealers are only doing this as an ulterior motive to, you know, deliver the planet to the Hive Mind, basically removes the actual legitimacy of their point. You know, it's just like with Chaos. You can imagine a Chaos cult springing up going, hey guys, we shouldn't be toiling 20 hours a day so that some guy above us can, you know, eat another 30 steaks in a day, right? We shouldn't be doing that. You and I, we're not eating enough food. Our children don't have enough food. Let's do something about this. And then, you know, as you go, as you start peeling back the layers, for every actual legitimate, you know, cult, or not a cult, every actual legitimate resistance to the Imperial system, it just turns out that at the end of it, oh, you know, they were being puppeted by a demon. Oh, you know, they were actually a front for the Gene Stealers. Oh, this or oh, that. And it's just like, okay, so what's going on here?
It's worse than that, almost, because it's not just that any resistance to the Imperium is a cult. It's any resistance against the Imperium or anyone trying to break away from it will eventually be adopted and by Chaos. In the Warhammer universe, Chaos is a mental thing that to resist it, you have to be part of a monoculture. So you have, like, in this extent past even the Imperium. So the Tau, while they are somewhat more egalitarian, they also are controlled by pheromones from their Earth cast.
The ethereal cast.
And the same thing with the Eldar, who are very focused on one role and one caste, and that's how they maintain that order, that structure to keep from Chaos. And so it almost every Xenos faction also has a monoculture. And that just is fundamentally... The orcs are the only ones who don't, but that's because they're basically a hive mind to begin... Well, they're not a hive mind, but they have... culture is chaotic, so to speak.
Yeah, they look for violence, and that's basically it. That's the only side of orcs, hitting things or building things to hit more things.
And it's things that really makes the setting somewhat overly rigid and flat is that they can only really tell certain stories.
Yeah, you know, are you familiar with the Soul Drinker Space Marine chapter?
I actually read their the books.
I love their books, actually. Chapter Seraphon, a chapter master with spider legs. What a cool idea. But, sure. You know, I actually did see someone do a conversion of that, and it looked really cool. But anyway, I'm getting sidetracked. The entire point of that is, oh, you know, we're Space Marines. We don't like the way that the Imperium is going. We're going to become, you know, we're going to do our own thing. We're going to fight for the Emperor's ideals, but not for the Imperium. And then they get ground into the dust. And it's like that for every single example. You know, there is no escape from, you know, the Imperial system. There's no... Here's the thing, right? Warhammer 40K is grimdark, right? But I've always argued that from a literary perspective, just from a writing perspective, you can't just write everything to be terrible all the time. Because what you do there is you basically induce a kind of apathy in your audience, right? Because if everything is always terrible, if there's no hope, if there's nothing really good to fundamentally look forward to, then you have two choices. You can sink into a kind of nihilistic apathy and just, you know, go with the flow, or you can come to do the other thing, which is bad, and that is you start to valorize and glamorize the bad stuff, right? And because there's no room for any real alternatives to the Imperium, because there's no room for any kind of goodness, quote unquote, to counterbalance all the dark, any kind of brightness, then it kind of makes the darkness kind of meaningless. You know, it is in a way almost comical to think about the comedy of errors that is the Imperium that keeps on trucking, you know?
I think it's also that grim darkness can work in moderation, but it's hard to create a universe that can support hundreds of novels based off of it. So like Cormac McCarthy's The Road, that's an extremely grim dark book. Like it's bleak. I haven't read it, but from what I understand it's bleak, but it's also from what I understand, a very good book. And
I have.
You can
it's
do that. You know, you can do that in the short term. You can create a work or even maybe 5 or 10 works that are grimdark. But again, the Warhammer canon needs to support hundreds of books, a bunch of games, and endless amounts of characters mm-hmm. that you can kind of explore yourself. And that's why something that's why it's limiting mm-hmm. to have it be so relentlessly grimdark and to constantly have to make everyone worse than the Imperium.
Yeah, yeah, I 100% agree with you. I feel like one of the things that fantasy did right, and something that Age of Sigmar is doing also right, maybe arguably a little bit better, is that it is trying to develop a setting where everything is not always perpetually grimdark, where there are moments of, this is actually, you know, good. These people are fighting not just for survival, but they're fighting for, you know, peace, right? Because, you know, there are many factions in this game that you could imagine could actually have a situation where, you know what, I don't want to fight. Caradon Overlords, they're a good example because they're ultimately not driven by violence. You know, they're not like grimdark, oh, we live in our sky cities, we're perpetually... No, they just want to trade, right? And a lot of... I've read a couple of their books, and a lot of that stuff is, yeah, you know, if we could just live... in peace, just trading, flying around, trading stuff, then that would be our ideal condition. And we don't want to be at war constantly because that's kind of pointless and expensive and so on and so forth. And, you know, that's totally different to something like the Imperium, where you can't imagine a state where the Imperium is just at peace. I can't, you know, even imagine, even when the, you know, Emperor was ascendant, even when the humans were, you know, at their highest, something had to give, and you know, it turned into chaos. And I feel it's a very negative outlook of, you know, both the setting, and it doesn't have to be that way. I don't think it has to be that way. I think there is space for Warhammer 40k to be less grimdark, and in the process of being less grimdark, it actually becomes the darkness that is there becomes more meaningful, right?
More interesting. You can say more interesting things about it.
Yeah, because. You know, the setting can't go on forever, right? What we saw with Warhammer Fantasy is that you... And Warhammer Fantasy was arguably a lot less grimdark than Warhammer 40k is, but you can't keep up that kind of attitude forever, because eventually people will just kind of peter out, you know? People will kind of lose interest in seeing where this thing is going, because you keep advancing the clock, you know, minute to midnight, but then you keep shortening the distance that you keep moving the clock, and you can't tell an interesting story so much because you're trapped by the constraints of the setting, because you can't change anything fundamental because there has to be eternal war, and you can't introduce new alliances, retire old characters, really shake up fundamental factions, you know, because the setting won't allow you to. the inertia of
static.
The setting, yeah, it's static. It's unchanging in a way. And it's, you know, it's like you said, it's fine for short periods of time, but Warhammer 40k is really, really old. And, you know, what we see nowadays is that the Games Workshop are trying to have their cake and eat it. They're trying to reinvent the setting. They're trying to kind of reboot a lot of stuff. And how are they doing it? Well, they're changing up the Space Marine designs. They're changing up, you know, they're bringing back Primarchs, I guarantee.
They're advancing the timeline, just something they were doing for a long time.
Yeah, they are trying to change things, trying to introduce, again, you know, stakes and all of that stuff. And it's just, well, yeah, I feel as if the setting would be, you know, that's the ultimate takeaway here, that the Genestealer cults are a very interesting faction. They are still, you know, very interesting even in the setting that is Warhammer 40k. But the problem is that they exist as part of the same kind of tapestry. There's no faction of the Imperium that is, or not of the Imperium, of the game that's just like, we are the renegades. We're going to break away from Imperial society. We are going to do our own thing. We are going to live free as free men, or, you know, die trying. And, you know, just have a faction like that. You know, you don't have to...
Really think that... be a really interesting direction for the setting to go. I mean, the newest iteration, the new the last, not edition, but a couple editions ago, moved the timeline forward so that the Imperium was split by this massive chaos storm, right? And I think it could be interesting for that storm to eventually abate. What happens is that in that time where they were isolated, the portions of the portions of the Imperium that were isolated grew differently, and then you could have different factions within the Imperium and have like infighting, and you could have some of that diversity of opinion.
Did I ever tell you about my idea of what a different Imperium would look like? Because I made a video about it. My most disliked video ever is where I came up with an idea for an alternative Imperium, and the idea was that instead of Well, I had this whole spiel about, there aren't any Space Marines, and there's just an Imperial army and all of that kind of stuff. Yeah, so I had this idea for an Imperium without Space Marines, without the superhumans, and so you would have quote unquote an Imperium faction, and I think you'd still have the Custodes, but that's a separate thing. But the idea that I had was that there would be a fragmentation of the Empire. In the way that the Holy Roman Empire, not Holy, the actual Roman Empire split, where you had the Western Roman Empire and the Eastern Roman Empire, because now you have the Imperium that is split into the Imperium Nihilus and the Imperium proper, split by the Citrix Maledictum. So what I thought, w which would be an interesting idea, would be if instead of having the Imperiums kind of maintain a tenuous control. I would imagine that they cut off communications from the Imperium Nihilus, and we advance the timeline, and then the warp storms abate, and then they find out that the Imperium Nihilus is a very different place. That the people who live on that side of the galaxy no longer feel as if they can trust the people who live on the other side of the galaxy, and like the people who weren't affected by the warp storm, who weren't cut off, they feel as maybe those people are now tainted. And that creates two basically new Imperiums, right? One which is the old Imperium, which hangs on to its old ideas and its old structures, and but then there's the new Imperium, which quote unquote the new Imperium, which is not really a unified thing, but rather a massive collection of independent worlds that can have various different kinds of governments, and various different kinds of political systems and various different kinds of planets, to represent, more of a loosely confederacy of like maybe a couple of planets here and there, this kind of stuff. And I thought that would be an interesting idea, because that would kind of
Yeah, I think
solve.
that would definitely be helpful. And yeah, like you said, fix a lot of the. It would just give a lot of options, I think, for writers. One of the cool things about Warhammer is the kind of limitless
Yeah,
size of
you've got a whole
the
galaxy.
universe.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you can't really explore anything besides the Imperium culture proper, because everyone who's not Imperium is Chaos or Xeno.
Or gonna either be a turn into a chaos puppet or a Xeno puppet, or they're just gonna be dead. There are problems, of course, with my idea. One of those problems is the Blood Angels chapter, which is a very powerful chapter of Space Marines, is in the Imperium Nihilus, and Dante is, I think, the commander of the Imperium Nihilus. So people would not. I think people would be very upset. I think, we run into this problem again of many of the fans would be very upset if we shook up the franchise, in a way. And we're not even talking about like, one of our more contentious opinions of, oh, let's have female space marines. We're just saying maybe the Imperium should actually splinter. Maybe it should actually break. And we should have a new period of galactic instability, but also maybe a new period of maybe we could do something else. Maybe we can build a new kind of society, one that is not so terrible. One that is not so, I would argue, grim derp, that because Warhammer is full of really dumb things that eventually, when you read it for the first time, you're like when I read some of the stuff as like a 12-year-old or 14-year-old boy, it's like, wow, that's so edgy and dark. But now that I read it, it's just very stupid. Oh, you're just gonna kill millions of people because you think maybe, just maybe, it's like, come on, guys, you can do a better job of investigating than that. It's just like, they do stupid things.
Because there is a certain amount of diversity of opinion in the Imperium now, but it's very slight, and it's not a movement, really. So, for example, there was the conflict between the Space Wolves and the Inquisition, where the Inquisition wanted to murder a bunch of people because they thought they might be chaos-tainted. Right, yeah, and the Space Wolves were like, no, we're not doing that. So they actually came to blows. Mm-hmm. And that's interesting, but it's not as though the Space Marines or the Salamanders, which are another chapter that kind of values human life, are making an effort to reform the Imperium as a whole.
No.
They just have slightly different rules of engagement.
Yeah.
And I think it would be interesting to have factions that are trying to change the Imperium.
Actually, you know, now that you bring it up, I think it would be remiss of me to not talk about the Hexarchy Crisis. Are you familiar with that?
Not the name.
So one of the most recent bits of lore is a mini civil war that happened on Terra because of Robote Guilliman. So when Guilliman came back, the High Lords of Terra were split, kind of, right? Because many of them didn't want to give up their power. And a lot of them actually started the scheme against Guilliman to keep him from becoming the Lord Commander of the Imperium, right? And the idea was that, when we did this whole Imperium thing, when the Emperor was put on the throne, no Primarch was allowed to claim, a position of power, and everyone's like, what are you talking about? Guilliman is a god. He's a demigod. Let's, put him in charge. He's the only one who can save us. And it caused a mini civil war to break out on Terra, essentially. Imperial forces were mustered against, one another. The custodies and stuff like that, they were, ready to, they were holed up in the Imperial Palace. It wasn't exactly, it didn't exactly come to blows because at the end, it turned out that Guilliman had already kind of foreseen this thing and maybe sent an assassin to kill all of the, rogue High Lords of Terra and cement his regime. But a lot of the opposition to Guilliman's regime was that he's quote-unquote a liberal reformer. he wants to...
Wait, just means efficient, really.
Yeah, yeah.
He's not liberal in that way. He just isn't as... married to orthodoxy.
He recognizes that this idea of doing inefficient things for the sake of tradition is ultimately less useful than just streamlining the process, getting new technology, getting new kinds of marines, etc. For a moment there was a chance, there was a serious potential chance here for maybe the kind of thing that I was talking about to happen, where the High Lords of Terra break away. They decide, okay, well, we refuse to acknowledge the legitimacy of Guilliman. We are going to gather the loyalists, the true believers in the Imperium, and we are going to go do our own thing. And then Guilliman is left kind of, with his own version of the Imperium. And then you have a genuine fragmentation of, Imperial society in a way that allows for different explorations of ways to govern, ways to exist, and really for a criticism of the Imperium that actually can come from a legitimate place,
Thing is that Gilliam actually did that at one point during the Horus Heresy, when he thought the Imperium was lost. He created the Imperium Secundus for like a hot minute.
He made a Sanguinus the ruler of the Imperium Secundus. Arguably, the realm of Ultramar, Imperial Secundus, is probably a nicer place to live than most of the, Imperial places, because it is, quote-unquote, primarily a democratic place. But, it was a fairly short-lived idea, and it's not something that is really explored more in the in the lore, because even if Ultramar itself is, maybe they have a democracy, maybe it is a fairly good place to live, they still comport themselves into a structure that is perfectly suited for, the Imperial hierarchy. Once you zoom out of Ultramar, then every planet is just contributing tides, contributing soldiers. It's not really...
A friendly version of fascism.
Yeah, it's not really
a changing of the fundamental structure.
Yeah, it's not really offering a critique of, the system and challenging it in that meaningful way, because, the question we have to ask ourselves is if Ultramar is so great, why isn't it more Why isn't the model of Ultramar more widespread? Why isn't that kind of governing system more popular? And the answer is because the people of Ultramar aren't really all that concerned with spreading, their ideas, and they're perfectly willing to comport themselves into the imperial system, and that by necessity means that they have their own culture. Democracy is part of their culture, but they're not really interested in making fundamentally the Imperium a more democratic institution. That's
I think
just.
what it comes down to a certain extent, is that right now, like with the Space Wolf thing, anyone who in the Imperium who has a different view is still part of the Imperium. It's sort of like there's disagreements among brothers, but we're still all on the same team. And I think what would be much more interesting, and maybe something that they could do, is once the I actually think what they should do, right, is kind of what I was going back to, which is the Imperium actually wins against Chaos for a bit, and the next storyline is the Chaos Storm's abating, and these new the Imperium worlds that were changed while they were disconnected come into conflict, because then you could get just a variety of different views, and you would actually have someone in conflict with the Imperium who is not bad and isn't a puppet of Chaos or of the Gene Stealers.
They have an ideological difference to what the Imperium is, and it's that thing of like the Eastern Roman Empire versus the Western Roman Empire, which are very culturally very different. And maybe the Imperium Nihilus could be the Western, or maybe the Eastern Roman Empire, because it'll be the changed one. It'll be the one that looks different. It looks back at the old system and looks at this, decrepit, decaying rule, and goes, well, actually, maybe we can do better, and so on and so forth. Maybe they realize the value of, making decent living conditions for everyone, so that people aren't inclined to fall for, a cult that springs up on the planet. We are almost out of time.
Would just really quickly, Games Workshop would love that, because then they could create a bunch of different models. You could have Space Marine chapters that had to come up with different equipment. You could have different
Oh
Imperial Guard
yeah,
models,
I would love that,
but most
actually.
would care about.
I would love to see an attempt to design maybe a different kind of Imperial model. Maybe we could finally have that Tau Space Marine Imperial, alliance that we've all been thinking about. So we are almost out of time. I just want to say maybe one last thing, and then we can go. But here's what games, all of this is fine and dandy. But here's what Games Workshop should really do. They should do the Horus Heresy, but with orcs. There's an artist on Reddit whose name escapes me, but they're doing such a fantastic job of presenting a miniature version of the Horus Heresy, but happening with orcs. And that is way more interesting, I think, to follow than anything that's going on right now with the Imperium, because like Ghazghoul is the Emperor, and he has 20 prime orcs that are his favored warlords, and they're all like really interesting, and they're all basically copies of Imperial Primarchs, but orcified. So you've got Vol'kan, who is an orc who killed a star dragon and is obsessed with flamers. You have Angron, which is really just Angron, but an orc. And that's what Games Workshop should really be focusing on. But that's
There's actually an effort to do that in conversions. You can follow the hashtag, I think, on Instagram of Prime Orc, which is basically everyone taking a different. It's not supposed to be a serious thing, but taking a different Primarch and making an orky version of it.
My favorite one that I've seen so far is the one for Lionel Johnson, who is like a knight, but an orc. It's really cool because they take all of the design language of the Imperium, and they're like, what if all of this was orc stuff? So they make him a full suit of armor. He's got a knightly helm, a great big great sword, and it just looks really cool to me. But this was a fun episode. I think the moral of the story here is that we should talk about what we could do to fix the Imperium, not because we just want to ruin 40K, but because 40K is something that could be a lot better than it actually is. And just like the Imperium itself, it needs to be challenged in order to do that. We will never be able to improve 40K by blindly, or just totally just following whatever Games Workshop says and tells us. We have to actually be critical and analyze what they're doing with the setting, and be able to interrogate what that means and have suggestions for moving forward, which we do. Kitbosh, any final thoughts?
I think we covered it all. I think there's a lot of interesting places Warhammer 40K could go. And we'll have to see if Games Workshop actually wants to do any of them.
Yeah, because we want this to go in interesting places. I like the direction Age of Sigmar is going. I feel like Warhammer 40K could go in that kind of direction. But we have to be brave to take those steps. But anyway, that's all the time we have for this episode. We hope you enjoyed it. Kitbosh, please shout out your stuff.
You can follow me on YouTube at Kitbosh. So
the link will be in the description of this video. Please check it out, folks. It's a really great channel. Watch his stuff where he makes Xbox huge orcs. Those are always great. This has been a Bite Marks special episode. We are on YouTube. Like, share, comment, and subscribe, please. You can find us probably wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, those kind of places. We have a Patreon now. If you have a dollar or two, you can give us one. That would really, really help. And share the videos, talk about them amongst your friends. Comment below what your favorite Gene Stealer cult model is. Mine is the Kellermorph. And maybe give this video a like if you want Kitbosh to make a giant mutant Gene Stealer. All right. Thanks, folks. Have a good one. Goodbye. And